It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaskans are making winter gear here in Alaska that you can buy, tuned for local conditions, often made of Alaskan materials, and decorated with Alaskan artwork. I talked to some of them over the last few weeks as they were gearing up for the Christmas shopping season, and you'll hear those interviews today, including a snowboard maker and a bike designer and builder. These are outdoors people who have turned their passion for snow into businesses manufacturing products you can use. We'll learn about their wares and the inspiration and struggles of making snow gear locally. It's something to love about Alaska, as the intensity of the way people recreate turns into businesses making products for Alaskans. And with me now is Stephen Shortridge, who's one of the partners with Chugach Flyer Snowboards. If you don't know that snowboards are being manufactured in Alaska with Alaska art right here in the South Central region, you're probably not alone, because they haven't been doing it all that long, but they've got a factory that's operating, making these custom boards, and they even have a factory showroom where you can go out and see one and buy one for Christmas if they haven't all been sold by now, because I'm sure they're really popular. So thanks a lot for being with us, Stephen.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
So I found that, I mean, a lot of Alaskans invent stuff, Alaskans create cool stuff, and it usually has to do with their own personal passion for something. And I guess this came from your passion as a snowboarder and your desire to have something new that you could use.
That's correct, yes.
So tell me about that.
Well, about 3 years ago, I wanted to have a custom snowboard made with a photograph that I had taken of the Chugach mountain range in Alpenglow, and I contacted several companies, and the price they offered me was fairly ridiculous for the amount of additional labor it requires. So I looked into starting my own company, and that's how we got it going.
So I'm sure that wasn't super easy. I mean, you had to go out and find somebody who could manufacture these things for you, essentially?
Right. Initially, that's how we started off. We found a company in the lower 48 that will do custom work on a contract basis for either one-offs or small production lot runs. And we worked with them for our first 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And they produced a number of products for us. Now we have our own production capability in Alaska. And we have our own tooling. We have a complete shop. And we can build custom on our own.
Yeah. So tell me how you decided to make that jump, because I think people these days assume that everything you buy is coming from China or coming from overseas, but you're actually manufacturing here in Alaska.
Yeah, that's correct. Initially, I wanted this custom board, and after looking into it, I found that in order to really have credibility within the industry, if you're a small producer, you have to hand produce the products yourself. And if you're having them contract made, they just kind of look at you as a relabeler in some regards. So that's kind of why we would decided to move into our own production ability. And it's been a fairly intensive learning curve, and of course required a fair amount of cash to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even start to know how to make a snowboard. I mean, how did you learn?
Well, actually, there's I spent some time in the factory with the people that I had contract building for me. And then there's actually a lot of good videos on YouTube and Vimeo where you can see various production techniques and process in factories elsewhere.
Oh, cool. So what was it like the first time you got on your very own snowboard that you had essentially conceived of and built? I just think that must have been quite a thrill.
Yeah, it was actually very exhilarating. And to actually, you know, have gone through the entire process of doing the design work, doing the engineering, the tool pathing with the machines, the building, it was really very rewarding the first time I got on it, and it actually worked as intended.
Uh-huh. What are the characteristics of your boards? And I'm interested in if that's something that you kind of tuned after you had started, you know, building them.
Well, I had a lot of experience riding different manufacturers' boards. Over time, I had ridden about 30 different models from different manufacturers. And so I had a good idea of what I wanted in a board for different purposes. And snowboards are built, in many cases, for specific snow conditions or riding styles. And so we build different board styles and types. And of course, different sizes for different size riders. But But the key is the board needs to suit the kind of terrain and the riding style that you're using for it to be most effective. And so we have several different board designs that we've engineered and are now producing.
Uh-huh. Do you, I mean, I guess the testing and trying out of the boards is like what everyone would dream of being the fun part, but that's probably an incredibly small part of your business.
Well, it's a small part of the business itself. Most of the work is in the shop or in the promotion. However, that's one of the parts of the business that just makes it incredibly fun to be a part of.
Yeah.
I was able to go to New Zealand in August, and I tested a new product line there and was quite pleased with the outcome. And in fact, on our website, there's a couple of video clips on our Facebook page, actually, Chugach Flyer Snowboards on Facebook, where you can see some helicopter video and some resort video of our boards being ridden.
Okay, cool. Well, and folks who want to find that can go to alaskapublic.org. We have Stephen's site and Facebook page linked at the page for today's show. So just take a look, and you can find out all about it and even pricing and designs and where to go to buy the boards. So you ended up setting up a shop as well as a factory,
right,
which is another whole business. I mean, setting up businesses is not easy, but I guess you decided that was a necessity to really reach your customers, huh?
Well, you know, when there's not a lot of retail space available for this kind of product, it is a niche market, and there was very inexpensive retail space available in this location. It is out in the valley north of Wasilla. It's at the Big Lake Road turnoff off of the Parks Highway, and I had been a tenant in that building, and that's where our actual production facility is located. So I was able to get a really nice deal from the management and use this space. And so we've set up a nice little showroom there. We've got a number of boards on display along with our other soft goods, and it's a place where people can come and talk to us, and where we could take a custom order, where they can see the stuff that we've already built, wiggle it, step on it, whatever, and get a sense of, you know, how it would feel to them. And we do offer, for those who are seriously interested, we can do demo boards where they could, you know, sort of rent a board for the day and take it out and try it out. Powder Hound in Girdwood, which carries our boards, has had that available for the last 3 years. And demos are really important to sales. People can try your product and see if they like it.
Uh-huh. I think that's so cool that you could actually go out to the factory where your board is being produced and buy it from the guys who are actually making it. I mean, can they actually look in the workshop or maybe not, huh?
Well, you know, that there are issues there with liability in that.
Right, right.
One of the services that we do offer if someone wants a custom board is that we can do video and photo production as that board is being built. And I'm willing to show those people the production facility when we're not actually, you know, running machines and what have you, where there's no real risk. If they're interested in that and they order a custom board, they could certainly get a little tour of the factory if they like.
So when you talk about a custom board, they can have their own artwork on the board, and they can sort of specify, you know, which design they want to use and that kind of thing?
Right. We can work with custom graphics. We just got in a large 36-inch wide Epson industrial printer, which we'll be using for the dye sublimation printing. Currently, I'm having those produced elsewhere. That's the only part of the production that I can't do in-house, and we are acquiring the tooling to be able to do the dye sublimation printing in-house. So we're fully vertically integrated in the sense of production. We use Alaska wood, aspen, birch, and Sitka spruce, all Alaska sourced, and that's in the core of every board. Our boards also are certified made in Alaska for the product that we produce here. And we have that logo on our products. So a person can take one of our snowboards and take the heart of Alaska with them to ride anywhere in the world they want to go.
It's cool. It's really interesting. It's really actually encouraging as an Alaskan to know that this kind of stuff is going on. Show is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking with Stephen Shortridge, who is one of the owners of Chugach Flyer Snowboards, which is manufacturing and selling their boards in the Matanuska Valley here in, you know, and you can also see them on their website by checking out our website at alaskapublic.org. So the artwork for the, sort of the non-custom ones, but the ones that you're selling in your line, there's one I'm looking at that has a kind of a Tlingit design, a sort of Southeast Alaska design. And I think I might have seen this particular board last year at Alyeska. Is that possible?
Yeah, that board was actually put into production about a year and a half ago, that graphic.
It's very eye-catching, I have to say. I mean, I'm remembering it a year later.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's a very dramatic design. We have artwork on two boards that was done by a Tlingit artist from Juneau, whose name is Rico Worrell. And he has his own business where he produces artwork, and he has a line of skateboard decks. And so it was that skateboard deck connection that, that brought him in to do some artwork for us. We also work with another artist from Old Harbor Kodiak, Lena Snow Amison Byrne, and we have one graphic done by her so far. I've designed a few myself, so our focus is to use Alaska art, and one of our projects over time is to do a series of snowboards called the Alaska's Original Artist Series, where the goal is to have at least one board in our production inventory that represents the cultural art style of all of the major tribal and cultural groups within the state of Alaska.
Oh, that's great. And then you've also got this board that's with graphics designed by the artist of Tundra, Chad Carpenter, which has got, like, it's got cartoons all over it.
Right, yeah. Chad Carpenter has done two exclusive graphics for us that we commissioned, and that artwork is not available through any other source but on our snowboards. And additionally, in relation to that, one of Chad Carpenter's associates is working on a new project. They had recently done their Moose the Movie project, and now they're working on a reality TV show that is called Powder Hunt, and they have a website, powder-hunt.com, and Chugach Flyer is a sponsor for them on this, and we're working with them because they're doing a GoFundMe program, and so Chugach Flyer is going to be involved in the premiums on that, and we're also going to do some on-snow filming with them, so I would encourage people to look into that as well and perhaps help support them.
That's great. Hey, and it looks, just looking at your website, it looks like you kind of have fun too. I see that your title, Stephen Shortridge, President, CEO, and Senior Test Rider, and then right below that, Judith Shortridge, Vice President for Enlightenment and Rightness. I mean, it must be kind of fun to be running a local business where you're not uptight. You're sort of just creating something that's cool and enjoying your friends.
Well, you know, the idea of this is to take something that we love and make it a bigger piece of our lives. And I think we're well on the road to doing that.
Uh-huh. Tell me about some of the, I mean, this has not been easy, I'm sure. And I'm sure there have been setbacks. Everybody who started a small business has run into problems and of every kind in terms of funding and, you know, finding a site and employees. And then you've also got the really challenging aspect that you're manufacturing out of local materials, which adds a lot of complication that, you know, many manufacturers would not have, who are, you know, would get some standardized materials. It can't have been easy to get up to this point you're at now.
It's taken a lot of work. We've been working on the shop altogether for about 2.5 years now. We pressed our first boards in June of last year, 2014. We have been building now for a year and a half. We've got two different models in three different sizes in current production and getting prepared to build some additional models coming up over the course of the winter. It's a lot of work. It does cost a lot of money in terms of the initial investment. Some of the machinery is quite expensive. Some of it we actually had to build ourselves. So it's been a long process, a big learning curve, but I think we're getting to the point where we're seeing some daylight in terms of the production. And the real big challenge is to increase our marketing footprint and get more recognition by people, particularly in the local community, that we're here, that we're building boards here, and that we want to support local riders.
Yeah. It's super impressive that you've reached this point. And I guess I wonder if there's an aspect where you need to be supported by the community of boarders here, or it doesn't fly. I mean, are you sort of at that point now where you got to say, well, wow, is this thing really going to work financially? Because you got to sell these things, right?
Right. Yeah, I've been selling some over the past few years, you know, and I have a 5-year plan as sort of my goal, and I think we're going to achieve that. You know, this is not something that you can jump into this market and you know, immediately gain recognition. There's a certain skepticism among riders who have seen, you know, small companies come and go. A lot of people have tried to do this out of their garage and have not been successful. And the biggest thing really is that most people run out of cash before they get to that critical mass point where they're really selling enough to cover their costs.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have a little bit of luxury in that I have a day job, which provides me a good financial support. And that gives me that ability to work on this and to be able to support it until it reaches that critical mass. But in the end, it's going to be the riders locally and in the Northwest that will either help us to succeed or ignore us and it won't work at some point. So I would really encourage the local riders to consider supporting your local board company. And we can get you out on some boards for some test runs if you like, do some demos. We will be doing demo days at Alyeska. Last year they were doing the first Saturday of every month, they were doing demo days where local shops could set up a tent and people could demo their boards, and it would be all organized through the resort rental service. And so we would like to offer that to people that we plan to be out there if they're doing that again this year, as they tell me they're going to do. And so once a month, we'll have boards at Alyeska for people to ride. And for those out here in the valley who ride at Hatcher, you know, we're not that far from Wasilla, and you can come by and we'll have demo boards. You will have to be 18 or older in order to get a demo board for legal reasons, and we will, you know, need ID and all that stuff. But, you know, people can try these boards. They are available. We build them with exotic materials like carbon fiber in some cases.
Uh-huh. And it's a great website. You can learn a ton about Stephen's boards on the website, which is linked at ours at alaskapublic.org, or just go direct to chugachflyer.com. And I'm excited about what you're doing, Stephen. You know, I imagine you don't have enough a lot of time off running a new manufacturing business and working another job. But it sounds like you're still having fun, and I hope people do support it, because it's great to have this Alaskan stuff where we can create our own identity through the stuff we buy, and it's all part of being Alaskan. And then when you see these boards out in the slopes, you kind of feel good to see them, to see that that's something from here. So I guess I'd say thanks for doing it, Stephen, and thanks for being on the show.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity to contribute and the opportunity to tell people about our program and our products.
All right. So that was Stephen Shortridge. He is the boss, the CEO at Chugach Flyer Snowboards, and a co-owner of that business. And I thank him very much to be with us. Please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats next Thursday at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Monica Gokey. We're going to take a quick trip down memory lane here. Earlier this year, we recorded a similar and awesome program on Alaskans who make their own equipment. One of our guests on that program was Dmitry Sidorov. He's a Russian-turned-Alaskan mountaineer and outdoor adventurer. And he has some pretty crazy stories about how Russian mountaineers used to procure the equipment they needed from behind the Iron Curtain. So we're going to play a snippet of that program right now. Here's Dmitry and Charles.
Hey, tell us, the listeners, about a story about how you would use your Russian equipment to sort of buy Western equipment, sort of this like barter arrangement. Like sort of like, again, sort of the one person to one person deal.
Well, once you figure out something and in the behind the Iron Curtain, you know, we didn't have a lot of, international equipment or real equipment. So we would commission mechanics, somehow coax them into making something industrially, like ice screws. And it's a famous, very, very well known among climbers piece of item, infamous Russian ice screws that are very cheap, made of titanium, used on atomic submarines, stolen from maybe one or some of them.
Oh, you're kidding. So, somebody who was working in a machine shop is making pieces of submarines. And
right here. So, I have two of these ice screws, I brought one for Eric, one for Charles. So, you would talk to them, and give them, I don't know if I can say it on air, like a bottle of vodka too. Uh-huh. And they would cut you these pieces, you know, overnight.
Okay.
And then you go to meet in foreign climbers and you trade that stuff for whatever you want or whatever they want.
Because the foreign climbers, it's the most exotic souvenir they could possibly have.
Well, and like plastic boots was such a desirable item those days. I got my first pair of Asala. Black, yellow plastic boots for 20 this ice screws, and I just want to give you guys one of them.
So that's like a bottle of vodka for some ice screws, and then trade those to the
pretty
boots.
Much. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, these are pretty nice, though. Yeah.
Did this come from a submarine then?
I don't know.
Wow, so it's
but it's a titanium thing, mm-hmm. So it's like
it seems like
super
holds body weight.
Yeah,
it seems like it's pretty nicely made.
Yeah,
too.
It's an industrial standard. So.
Nice. Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Do I now owe you like a little bottle of vodka?
Nah, not at all. Enjoy.
We'll be back in a minute. In the meantime, this is Alaska artist Michael Howard with Tiny Birch Basket.
I met a child. She was a witch in disguise. She floats in the bay in a tiny birch basket. I saw through her eyes. I asked if the tide was coming in or the land was going out to see. We were not real until we stood beside the ocean. We could not feel until we swallowed the sea. Thin painted eyes, searching to find what painted eyes cannot see.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I now have in the studio with me James Stull, who is an owner and founder of 907 Bikes. I'm sure you've seen these bikes around town. Seems like they're really popular. And I love the name, you know, that it's like totally recognizes the sort of the local development of fat tire bikes. Thanks for being here, James.
Ah, thanks for inviting me.
So it seems like fat tire bikes are just going crazy. I mean, especially in the last couple of years of bad snow, all kinds of skiers are giving up skiing. And they, once people try them, they don't ever want to, you know, go back.
Yeah, it's grown quite a bit. The poor snow conditions, you can buy studded tires now, and you can still get out and get some fitness when there's no skiable snow.
Yeah. Do you remember when you first rode a fat tire bike?
I do, yeah. In 04, well, 05, we were doing... 04, we did a fat bike race, the Susitna 100, and yeah, conditions were really, really poor. And then 05 is kind of when the mass production Surly fat bike came out, and it was like, wow, this is a big difference. You can actually ride it in the soft snow. So
yeah, these bikes really came out of racing, didn't they? They came out of those long distance winter races.
Yeah, they did. And the Susitna 100, the Ultra Sport stuff, that 350. Yeah, so anything soft snow, the more flotation you needed, the better. But now it's turned into your winter mountain bike on the hillside and Kincaid trails. So,
and you see me even in the streets. And I was on the East Coast this summer, and I was on Block Island, which is off of Rhode Island. Like, it's this little sandy vacation island. Getting off the ferry, here's a guy riding his fat tire bike right off the ferry, right? So it's like really going everywhere now because you could use them on sand.
It is, yeah. And the sand thing is, it's growing quite a bit. The sand, beaches, yeah. And then, yeah. So it's fun to hear, oh, I saw one of your bikes on the East Coast. It's grown so much now. Yeah, you're right. It's like you can commute on them. There's studded tires, there's fenders. It's pretty amazing to see all the other manufacturers jumping on board and growing the fat bike.
So I think most people know the advantage is that the bike will ride on top of soft material, snow or sand or whatever. Disadvantages? I mean, do you see people like giving up their regular bike? I mean, it seems like it's probably slower and more effort to ride a fat tire bike, although some people have told me that if you've got the right tires, it's not. So,
yeah, that's kind of been the evolution of the whole fat bike. So in the beginning, they were heavy. You see it, you're like, wow, that thing must be really heavy. And you pick it up and you're like, wow. So you ride them around and your winter fitness was really good going into the spring. Now they're all pretty lightweight. I mean, it all depends on how much money you want to spend, but you can get a fat bike now just as light as your summer mountain bike. There's now suspension fat bikes. So some people are just opting to ride those things all the time. They have one bike. Sometimes they'll put 29-inch regular mountain bike wheels on it. So it's kind of a interchangeable thing.
Oh, really?
So,
I didn't realize you could do that.
Yeah, you have to buy a new set of wheels. Uh-huh. But that's kind of a, if you have a couple $1,000s to spend and you're like, I want to buy one bike, and yeah, somebody will buy a fat bike and then buy a set. So then it's a 29-inch mountain bike.
Right.
At that point also in the
summer. Is this a wheel with a wider hub? Because I mean, they've got a wider fork on the fat tire bike, right?
Exactly. So the spacing, the fork spacing and the frame spacing is different from a traditional mountain bike. So you have to buy, when you buy the wheel set, you would say, I have this brand, this is my hub spacing. And then you buy a set of hubs and pick the rims, and then the shop would build them up for you.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Yeah.
So let's go back to when you began deciding that you were going to be a bike manufacturer, essentially. Now, you had a bike shop, so you already were sort of halfway there.
Yeah, so we opened up a Chain Reaction Cycles in Anchorage in 06, and it was one of those, we're riding Surly bikes, and we could probably make this bike a little bit better. And yeah, we're like, let's try it. Do a small batch of these aluminum frames. We were really one of the first companies to do an aluminum fat bike because they were all steel at this time.
So you're taking some weight off.
Yeah, that was the goal. One of the big ones was knock the weight down and then some geometry tweaks.
Because there's no reason why a fat tire bike had to be a tank. It was just that when they were first being developed, that wasn't the emphasis, so they didn't worry about the weight so much.
Yeah, there was custom companies making fat tire bikes, but they were making them out of steel and titanium, and they were really expensive for most people.
Okay.
Surly Bikes was making these $500 frame sets out of steel, but they were heavy. They were really, really heavy. Uh-huh. And we're like, the one thing we can do is knock a couple pounds off this thing. So we got a hold of a small manufacturer out of Portland, did a batch, a small run, and started advertising that we're doing it. And
so you designed the frame and sort of the logo and stuff like that and send it down to them, and they built the frame off of your specs that you sent to them, or how does that work?
Yeah, exactly. So we make the design changes we want, dealing with a bike engineer, and he puts it in what they need to manufacture. Uh-huh. And yeah, typically they build a prototype and we try it and see it and make sure everything looks good. And then
fun.
It's always fun. Yeah. When it comes in exactly the way you want it and it works, that's the good part. Yeah. And then, after that, there was one of those, this is going to take off, I think. And then we also say, yeah, now we have a bike shop and a bike company. So
so tell me, I mean, that's always interesting in the growth of a business when it sort of catches, you know, when it hits and it actually looks like it's going to work. So with 907 Bikes, what happened that made it like, or how did you like see that this is really going to be popular?
I think the amount of... We got to keep in mind we were doing this out of a bike shop. So right. All of a sudden we have this.
You had some new inventory.
All of a sudden we have all these other bike shops in the U.S. and really the world calling us asking to become a dealer for these things. So they want to buy these bikes and become a bike dealer. And then it's like, oh, no.
How are those guys finding out about it, though?
Forums, like Fat Bike forums. At that time, it was Fat Bike forums, and we'd sell one to someone somewhere, and they would take pictures of it and post it.
Somebody wins a race on it or something like that.
Exactly. So it was just like, it was really, there was no marketing aspect to it, because, I mean, the batch of frames we got was really small. And then it's like, okay. And then
it just suddenly takes off, and you've got a great name. I mean, how did you come up with this name? It's such a good name.
At that time, my business partner was like, "What about this?" And I'm like, "Oh, that's a good idea." Just because most people get it, but the funny part is, there's a few people that are like, "What's that mean?" And
everything cool has to have a little bit of a little bit of that, right?
Exactly. And the whole fat bike thing really kind of started here in Alaska. I mean, that's it. So, one of the reasons why we use the 907 as the area code. So
that we get just from being in Alaska, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So suddenly you're faced with all these orders from shops around the country that want this hot, cool property to, you know, and you've got to figure out how to produce a lot more of them. That must be challenging.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the manufacturer that we were using in Portland couldn't keep up with production, and we moved it to Taiwan. And it's just a matter of the growth aspect of a business like that. Like running a bike shop is totally different, totally different than running a bike company. Just dealing with outside customers, and then dealers and trade shows and.
Well, I think the production and working with people in another country and importing them and all that stuff, there's a lot of complication in that, isn't there?
There is, yeah. It's shipping's a challenge, getting stuff done in time's a challenge. So, I mean, every year we have something that's like stuck somewhere. The whole last year, the issue in the ports out of California and Washington, that was a pretty big deal for us as a company. It didn't turn out too bad, but our stuff was sitting in the water waiting. We have a good contact guy that we work with in Asia that does a lot of communication for us if we need anything. And
So it seems like you have got to sort of hold on to some kind of a niche, because if you get really popular, then some big company can come in and probably you know, produce something that's cheaper, that they've got big, you know, advantages as a large company. Is that something you have to sort of be looking over your shoulder at?
Yeah, that's already happened. And really, it's really happened this year. It's been, we've known it's going to happen, but like a lot of companies were jumping on board, but Trek, for instance, Trek and like Specialized were the two big companies that just deep pockets that doesn't matter, you know, and they kind of waited and waited and they've now jumped on board with it. And yeah, it's, hasn't really affected us much. I think we were in the fat bike market, like really one of the first guys in the fat bike market. So we have this, exactly what you said, niche name. They see your 907, they automatically know that we're a competitive brand. We don't do tons of bikes like Specialized in Trek does. We just kind of stick to our niche. We're kind of a high performance race brand, really.
Yeah.
So
you don't have to be the cheapest. You just have to be the best and keep that sort of name.
Exactly. I mean, we, yeah, there's a lot of cheap fat bikes out there, and yeah, that's not what we do. I mean, we make quality stuff, and the thing is when the fat bikes came out, even customers were like, oh man, I don't want to spend that much on a bike. I want to spend $1,200 or so. And so what's happening is those people are like, I bought that $1,200 bike and this was really fun. I really like this bike. And they upgrade, they get something nicer. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been the way it's been rolling here the last couple of years. So the quality and the price point of those bikes are slowly going up and up, because now people are like, there's more options out there and the quality is really good.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about Alaskan made stuff that you can buy that has our Alaskan cachet and sort of is built for Alaska by Alaskans, or at least to the extent possible.
Yeah.
We don't actually have a frame factory in Alaska. So right now with me is James Stull, who's a owner and founder of 907 Bikes, which you've probably seen around. Those fat tire bikes that are kind of like going national and really getting a reputation. So it seems like there's these different, I mean, you were talking about this, the way the market works, and something gets invented in Alaska or develops in Alaska. I guess the two big ones really would be pack rafts and fat tire bikes are real Alaskan inventions.
Yeah.
And then as they get more popular, they maybe go to a mass market. And then the price might go all the way down a few hundred bucks for a really cheap one. But you're trying to keep sort of the Alaska name, and that's how you can be a manufacturer in Alaska, because your costs have got to be massively higher than somebody outside or somebody in Asia.
Yeah, I think the tough part for us, at least, is just shipping. It's freight, and that's really it. Everything else is not too bad. The shipping Asia to here and out of here is kind of tough, but a lot of negotiating with FedEx.
Right. So how does all this, tell me how this works. So people in Taiwan are building the frames, and then where does it go from there?
Yeah. So they build the frames and forks, and they send them to us directly to Anchorage. So they land in Anchorage. And
so you get like a container full of these things? Or?
Yep. We get a container full. We have a warehouse.
Hope that container doesn't go astray, right? Because that's got to be worth a fortune.
Well, insurance is a spendy on that one too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So they arrive here, and I have four or five guys, including myself. We have a warehouse really close to our bike shop also, and we kind of work together and build those bikes up complete, pack them up, communicate with dealers.
So they're ready for somebody to jump on the bike and ride it?
Well, if they did, some customers just order frames.
Okay.
So if you order a complete bike, that bike is completely fully built from from the frame to small parts here in Anchorage. And we build it.
That's very cool.
Yeah. We box it up and ship it all across the world. So
you run the whole company with this five or six people building the bikes?
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of share the employees between our bike shop and our 907 warehouse. So, yeah.
And yeah. so then you have to ship them from here to the store, and that's where you run into a lot of cost. Because those individual, I mean, it costs a lot to mail stuff in and out of Anchorage.
Exactly. Yeah. So we ship those. We have a couple different freight options that we use for dealers and consumers, and then we ship them out of here. But honestly, that's it's the exact same thing. It's a marketing. People like to get that bike built out of Alaska. If you're in Florida, it's like, I got this fat bike, and it.
It's a real Alaska one.
From Alaska.
Yeah.
And so for us it's a true marketing thing. I mean
And down there the 907 is even more like, mysterious, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you want to get bigger? I mean, do you want to be a bigger company, or do you think you're about the right spot for you know, running it the right way and sort of keeping on top of everything? It sounds like you're like right in there turning a wrench, so
off and on. I mean, I'm myself, I have a really good crew. So mm-hmm. my crew is amazing on both sides of my two businesses. I fully trust all of them. So, I'm definitely in day-to-day operations on both. Like this time of year, it's busy in both, but the 907 side is really busy. I mean, we're shipping out a lot of product to dealers to get stuff for Christmas. To grow, yeah. I mean, I always want the company to grow and get bigger. The tough part is not to grow too big, too fast, and then and then it's all chaos. So, I think we're doing a really good job of slowly building it up, keeping to our niche, keeping to what we do best.
So I would think that if you really wanted to grow, then you probably need to set up a factory somewhere else, right? You know, where it's easy, you know, shipping is easier and maybe labor's cheaper. Is that where would you go there, or would that sort of take away your special thing that you got?
Honestly, we've tried that. We did that once. Mm-hmm. We did it out of Ogden, Utah, and warehouse space is really cheap there. Employment's really cheap there. It didn't quite work out. If I did it again, I would probably do it in the same spot, and I would have to have one of my key guys move there. Mm-hmm. Just because, if you don't have a presence, like an older presence in a location out of Anchorage, it's super tough. It's just super tough.
Yeah.
But I think that would be the next step again, would just open up a second shipping facility in the lower 48. Yeah.
I think it's really, you know, people always used to talk about why can't Alaskan do manufacturing and value-added stuff, you know, but you've figured out a way to kind of sell the Alaska image, which is really what we've got that's of value to people outside. It's sort of this image and this know-how because of where we live.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple other big companies out there mm-hmm. that use Alaska as their market tool.
Yeah.
And they really have no
Alaska Airlines, right?
Yeah, no affiliation with mm-hmm. it, but it's just, and it's always kind of funny to me, but yeah, I mean, people dig the Alaskan build. Yeah,
so I think authenticity is really important when you're talking about high-end sports equipment, that people really, I mean, this is something people care a lot about, and they're not gonna want something that's a knockoff or that is not the real thing. They're gonna find out if they're gonna be spending this kind of money on something,
and we see that in Anchorage alone, like, just people want local Alaskan built stuff. They mm-hmm. they won't necessarily buy a Specialized or a Trek because they're like, oh well, we have these local fat bike companies here and these guys are legit, and they actually ride these I see these guys on the hillside riding these bikes.
Yeah,
and that's big for the local community, and I think it's sometimes bigger than the outside community too.
Uh-huh. So give me your sales pitch. We're coming near the end here. And did you sell them just at your shop, or do you sell them all over Anchorage?
No. So like dealer-wise in Anchorage, it's Chain Reaction Chain Cycles. Reaction.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Fairbanks. We have a dealer in Fairbanks and one in Juneau.
Why should I buy one of your bikes as opposed to something else? I mean, what's the sales pitch when somebody's coming in and saying, I don't know? And how much suggested price?
I mean, we have bikes. And we try. I mean, we try to stay competitive with every mm-hmm. all the other bike companies. Mm-hmm. So we have a bike that's $1,799 that starts and 907. I mean, it's typically with a bike at $1,799, it's a little heavier, and then you kind of go up from there to $2,700 mm-hmm. to $3,600. So yeah, I mean, I would just ask the. It's a budget thing, you know.
Yeah. But what do you get when you put in another 1,000? I mean, you're getting a lighter frame.
Aluminum frames are all the same, and then we have a carbon frame also.
So a carbon frame.
So typically, if you go up, you're going to get nicer components, carbon fiber handlebar, seat post, nicer tires, maybe a carbon fork. A lot of the bikes now are coming tubeless tires. Uh-huh. So it's kind of trickled over to the fat bike side.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, and weight loss, the bike's lighter, considerably lighter. Our best bike on our chain reaction is like a $2,700 build with a carbon fork and tubeless wheels. So people usually ride the $1,799 and try the $2,700, and then they're like, whoa, this is really light.
I want this one.
Exactly.
And they walk in and try one out, and you have them in stock so somebody could just get one, right? Or do you mostly buy order?
No, we have them. Usually we have them built on the floor in different package builds. We have 5 different color options in the aluminums and 3 different color options in the carbon bike. Uh-huh. So we don't have every single one built, but we have at least one L option on our floor at the whole time, at the same time. So if it's not the one you want, then usually for our shop, it's a day or two to build, to turn around.
For once, the back order to the manufacturer is not that big a deal.
No, definitely not. And it's been a learning curve for us at the shop. I mean, you see tons of fat bikes on the trail. So usually it's super busy. So our systems in the shop now are pretty good. So our turnaround's 1 or 2 days if we have everything.
So how many bikes are you selling in a year of the 907s or 907s? That's your trade secret. Okay. Well, we had to hit something you wouldn't answer. All right. Well, I want to thank you for being with me. James Stull, owner, founder of 907 Bikes. Very, very busy at this Christmas season, so I appreciate you coming in. And also Chain Reaction Cycles. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Hi everyone, Outdoor Explorer producer Monica Goki here. I'm going to take us through the end of the hour, and I have a really cool guest with me. His name is Logan Imlock. He's in Salt Lake City, and he joins us by phone. But let me tell you a little bit about him first. Logan is sort of your typical Alaska kid. He grew up skiing a lot, and it led him to a career as a professional skier. So he was in and out of places like Switzerland, the Alps, all over, while interchanging with shifts on the North Slope. And in the industry, he was known as the Maverick of rail skiing. And he'll laugh if you call him that. But anyway, things kind of changed for Logan when he lost his ski sponsor. So there was Logan, more or less, a ski addict with no free skis. So he put his engineering degree to work and he started making his own skis in his garage. And a couple of turns later, that landed him his dream job as a ski engineer with Armada Skis in Utah. Well, Logan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start by hearing about your job with Armada Skis. What exactly does a ski engineer do? It kind of sounds like a dream job.
It is. You know, it's a skiing job, so it's a pretty loose workplace. And basically, right now it's not what it'll always be. Right now, I'm sort of building out a prototyping facility, so I'm assembling CNCs and ski presses and getting everything kind of laid out so that we can begin prototyping skis, which is something that Armada didn't have the ability to do kind of in the United States because all of their manufacturing is over in Europe. So right now I have to build all of the equipment to build skis. And then after that, we'll get into designing and prototyping. And yes, skiing on the prototypes, which is really probably the hardest part. But yeah, I mean, it goes from a computer generated design into a made prototype, and then we ski on it, figure out what we like, what we don't like, and then go full circle until we have a final product.
Well, tell me about that prototype real quick, because you went from being kind of a guy who skis a lot to a guy who made his own skis, but sort of casually. How do you think that evolved into you getting this kind of job?
Well, it was funny. As soon as I actually, because I started out as a civil engineer, and I grew up in sort of a constantly renovating house, so I picked up a lot of carpentry skills at a young age. Went to engineering school, all the while, you know, skiing a bunch, and then I just didn't work in the oil and gas industry where I was rotating on and off the slope. And then kind of, I don't know, the pieces all kind of fell together. Like, I, when going to school and stuff, I'd never seen myself designing or building skis or anything like that. And finally, kind of when it all came together, my dad was like, my dad looked at me. He's like, well, I'm surprised it took you this long to realize this is what you're going to do.
That's awesome.
It would just kind of, yeah, it just kind of all, everything worked, you know.
Well, let's talk about your first pair of skis. Like, when you took them out on the slopes, did they fall apart or did they, you know, handle pretty well?
I am proud to say that I haven't broken any of my skis yet or delammed them or anything. And I actually attribute that to when I was putting them together, I know that I put way too much epoxy in. So they ended up a little bit heavier than they probably could have, but I think that excess epoxy just helped me not break any yet, and they haven't fallen apart. It's pretty funny. The first pair I built, I mean, I was just flying by the seat of my pants. And when I pulled them out and like flexed them, you can take, and skis are normally fairly rigid, but these things, you can almost bend them in half and they won't break. Like I've
seen some
people and I've been like, break these. And we're actually trying to like reverse engineer what I actually did to them to make them like that, so that we can take kind of that characteristic forward into some other projects. So like I stumbled upon something luckily, but yeah, it's actually pretty funny. Like the last pair of skis I built in my garage was probably the worst pair. Like it's so funny how you can ebb and flow with stuff like that. Like,
oh, right.
You're like all confident and you're like, oh, I'm doing so good. But then like you just miss one small step. Like I had forgotten to check the width on my fiberglass, and I get to where I'm all coated in epoxy all over my hands and all over everything, and figure out that my fiberglass isn't even wide enough for my skis. So I had to like just scramble to figure something out, because epoxy hardens in a certain amount of time. You're like, as soon as you start building, you're on a clock. And yeah, I mean, you get overconfident with something and it doesn't work out, and it's just like, I don't know. It's crazy how the process just like really, I don't know. It's such a process driven thing that you
sure
have to stay on top of.
And it sounds like you learned a lot through trial and error. When you were doing this in your garage, because presumably you didn't have any skis from a sponsor, were you selling them or just kind of doing it for yourself?
Doing it for myself and selling them. I wasn't selling them. No. The only pair that I actually have left, well, two pairs have. I gave a pair to a friend, and I gave a pair to my dad. So actually, three pairs have left. And then the third pair I auctioned off for kind of a benefit down here. But no, I hadn't planned to sell anything. Like it was just kind of, I was working in the oil field, so you know I had all this free time when I got back from work. That yeah, I just chose to kind of dedicate to it and make tools for my own use at the time.
Right, and tell me, you used to be a professional skier, and then that sort of ended for you, and now you're ski engineering. That must have been a pretty big life change. What was that like?
Well, it was. It wasn't. It wasn't actually. So being a professional skier isn't nearly the glorious life that it's made out to be. I don't know, have any hard stats or anything, but I venture to say probably only 20% of the people that you think are professional skiers, like, can make enough money directly from skiing to support themselves
sure.
for a whole year, you know. Most of them get summer jobs. Me, on the other hand, like, I rotated to and from the slope working on drilling rigs. So, like, that was better money than when I quit all that and then moved now to ski engineering, which, I mean, it's awesome. Like, there was one year when I was skiing and working on the slope that I only slept in my own bed like 13 times the entire year.
Oh my gosh.
So it's definitely a lot to be said for, like, being in one place at one time. Like, it's way better in a way now.
Yeah, and so in your job as a ski engineer, are you sort of getting to work with, like, the younger versions of you, like the people who are out there pushing the sport and learning what they want to see in skis?
Yeah, for sure. Like, that's actually one of the most interesting parts about it is, like, getting people. I'm definitely working with, like, Armada has an amazing team. Like, their team is top notch, and working with them. And the coolest part to me is, like, getting input from them about the skis, and sort of trying to. Like, I'm in tune with their terminology and stuff because I've been there for so long, that taking their, you know, their terminology and their notes about what they're feeling and trying to translate that into, like, quantifiable engineered results about the finished products. Like, that's the part that I'm just starting to scratch the surface of, and I think is, like, super, super interesting.
Oh, that's awesome. Sure. All right, last question. What is, like, your magnum opus of a ski? Like, if you could build one kind of super amazing ski, what would it be like?
Oh, there's so many. Like, I'm definitely to the point now where it's like I like to have the intended ski for each use. Like, for me, having a lot of taper in the nose and, like, really tight side cut is huge. And to be honest with you, I haven't designed my magnum opus ski yet, but I'm working towards it right now. And I'll probably be working towards it for the rest of my life.
That's awesome, Logan. Well, I think that's all I have for you. I appreciate you joining us.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. Like, that's fun.
And I think we'll put it there. Logan, we're glad to have you on the program. You were just hearing from Alaska skier turned ski engineer for Armada Skis, Logan Imlock. At the top of the hour, you heard from Stephen Shortridge of Chugach Flyer Snowboards, followed by Jamie Stoll from 907 Fat Bikes in Anchorage. This was a pretty fun hour of radio, and I'm glad you were here with us. Outdoor Explorer is produced by Charles Woolforth, Grace Bogine, and me, Monica Gokey. We'll be back next week with a program on snow machining. Until then, we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.